And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With you till 3 on this Tuesday afternoon with plenty to get to over the next couple of hours. Coming up, we had our home run derby last night and the All-Star game coming up tonight for Major League Baseball's All-Star break. Plus, why the Phoenix Suns actually benefit from tonight's Major League Baseball's All-Star game. The Pelicans hoping that they have Zion's new savior. Which college football teams will be the toughest to predict this year? Which NFL teams are pretenders or contenders? The Olympic team lost another exhibition last night for basketball. We'll get to our Tuesday top 10. And also, maybe get to some over-unders in college football later on this afternoon. And can Clemson keep up this run they've been on? We'll be joined by a former big leaguer next hour as well. Plenty to do over the next few hours. And you can join the conversation throughout the afternoon. 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show. 843-608-1734. You can get to us on Twitter at Morrow Middays, on Facebook, ESPN Charleston, via email, studio@kirkmanbroadcasting.com, or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Head on over there. It's your one-stop shop. You can leave a comment for the show by simply clicking on our show page. You can also find the latest versions of the show podcasted there. Or you can take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go by simply streaming us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With you till 3 on this Tuesday, Joe's on the steel wheels. Joe, what's going on? How are you?
Oh, this Tuesday is going quite well so far. About you?
Yeah, not too bad. A little rainy out there this morning. Got the All-Star game coming up tonight for Major League Baseball. The home run derby was last night. Let's start with that, because I thought it was interesting. I sat down, I watched it. I was actually looking forward to the home run derby. And I always tell you my little trick. There's not a lot of things that I watch live, even games. Right? I just avoid going online or picking up my phone to see a text from a friend that spoils it for me. I'll watch a game, I'll wait a half hour, start the game late, fast forward through the commercials. And that was nice last night with the home run derby. I fast forward through all the nonsense, right? All the commercials. Let me just see guys hit home runs. It was pretty fun and entertaining. And Peter Alonso gets another win. We'll hear from him in just a moment. But a couple of takeaways from last night's home run derby, because it is some just an exhibition. It's like a slam dunk contest, right? There's not much you can really take away from it. It's not a huge deal. It's just an exhibition. It's for fun. Last night at Coors Field, which is always a great setting for the event. Balls flying out of there. A few takeaways, though. Number one, from the viewing standpoint, as a viewer at home, while I enjoyed it last night, and I have to be honest, I watched every swing of the home run derby last night. I don't know the last time I did that. But good field, Coors Field, good field in terms of the participants, good field in terms of where it was happening. Shohei Ohtani, who's been one of the big stories this year, had some interesting players to watch. There was really nothing else going on last night anyways to watch in the sports world. I figured, yeah, why not? Let me watch some guys hit some home runs. And it was entertaining. But the one complaint I had for the viewer at home, it was kind of hard to follow at times. Now, I guess if you watched the StatCast broadcast on ESPN2, according to people online, that was the more enjoyable broadcast. But the regular broadcast on ESPN did the split screens, and you would see the batter swinging in the one box to the left, and then the box to the right was supposed to be tracking the home runs. But Major League Baseball, I think, have made two changes to the home run derby that has screwed up the viewing experience at home. The first one was years ago when they changed from going from 10 outs to a time limit. Because with 10 outs, right, I mean, you could have Josh Hamilton hitting 30 home runs. I mean, a couple of guys did that last night as well, but you could be up there all night until 10 outs if you're on a roll. In this case, with the time limit, you got 3 minutes. Right, whether you're clobbering home runs every swing or not, 3 minutes, you're in, you're out. Then they do this bonus 1 minute if you hit enough home runs or hit it far enough, whatever it may be. So they changed the time. So now, as you watch, right, they have a time limit. It's a time crunch. You can't take your time. It's not 10 outs. That'd be just like a baseball game where there is no time limit. You could take your sweet time. The game can go on if you're trailing. That's what you always say, right? There's no time. We control how much longer this game goes. They have to record outs. It's the same idea in Home Run Derby. You could take a break. You could watch. You hit the ball. You sit there and watch it sail. All right, ready for the next pitch, right? But Major League Baseball, in an effort to try to speed things up and also maybe get guys in and out quicker, limiting their swings, they went to this time limit. So now you have guys just trying to hit one after another. Makes it a little bit harder to follow. There were times when multiple balls were in the air at once, right? You couldn't even, like, which ball was that? Where did that one land? What happened there? Right, you had no idea sometimes what was going on, especially when Peter Alonso got on a roll. He hit, like, five straight home runs that were going rapid fire because he was up against the time limits. I have no idea what just happened. All I know is he's hitting home runs. I don't know where they're going. And that was always part of the fun, was when you would watch not only these monster home runs, you wanted to see where they landed, right? You would see the guys try to, the people in the stands try to make catches, see how far they hit it. And then, you know, Chris Berman used to marvel over it, and the player would even stand there and stare, crack a smile and with his victory of clobbering a home run 500 feet. And the second rule change that affected this as well was that this year was the first year where they did not force the pitcher to wait for the ball to land because of this time limit. Now, they used the time limit in the past, and they still had this rule that you could not throw a pitch until the ball landed for that reason, so that everybody could watch the first pitch that he hits and sees, oh, where did that go? Okay, now here comes another pitch. Let's see where he hits this one. All right, last night there was no such rule, so it was rapid fire. You know, you just keep it. It's like a three-point shooting contest. Don't wait to see if it goes in the rim. Just keep getting them up. Or not even a three-point shooting contest, but maybe more so like when you're playing in the arcade and you got 60 seconds to make as many shots as you can. You're not following through. You're not watching to see if it's going in. You're just grabbing a basketball and chucking it up there. That's this guy. Like, just throw it to him. Let me keep swinging. Try to hit as many out as I can. And so for the viewer at home, you're trying to keep up. It's like a tennis match, you know, played at two times the speed, going back and forth. You know, cranking your neck left and right to watch the ball go back and forth, trying to keep up with the action. Oh, it's going over here, and oh, over here. Oh, they returned it. Oh, you know, you're watching these guys hit home runs, one to left field, one to right field, two in the air at the same time. It's like, what's going on around here? But it was still an enjoyable night to watch the Home Run Derby. And, you know, for a derby, there was quite some drama, whether it was the swing-off, whether it was coming down to the final seconds or swings of a couple of those rounds and matchups. And then even Peter Alonso, the way he won, that bonus minute, I believe the first ball he hit did not go out. Then he hit five or six straight homers to walk it off. It was a pretty fun night at Coors Field to see the Home Run Derby. And my other main takeaway last night from the Derby was Shohei Ohtani. Now, Ohtani maybe didn't have the performance many were hoping. He was the favorite to actually win that thing. Lost in a swing-off pretty quickly to Juan Soto of the Washington Nationals. And Ohtani took him a little bit while to get into a groove. Right? He started off, he was slapping like line drives, which in a regular baseball game, those are good hits. But in a Home Run Derby, you got to get that ball elevated and hit out of the ballpark. And he found his stroke, and he started to hit him out, and he put on a nice show. No pun intended with the name. But he didn't end up winning. Didn't end up participating in the championship. But here's what I appreciate about Shohei Ohtani. He was out there last night participating in the Derby. He will be out there tonight starting on the mound. He'll be DHing as well. So you will see him hit in the top of the first inning. You'll see him pitch in the bottom of the first inning. We'll see how long he stays out there. If I'm Joe Maddon or the Angels, I'm a little concerned about tiring him out because we know, the data backs it up, guys who have really struggled after just the Home Run Derby alone. Then you factor in not only the Home Run Derby, but playing in the All-Star Game, and not only playing in the All-Star Game, but playing both sides. He'll be pitching and hitting tonight. Probably won't be playing the field, but will be out on the mound instead. Just participated in the Derby last night. Those guys take a lot of swings. Playing in the All-Star Game tonight in two different ways. Then they get back to baseball in 2 days. You hope for the sake of the sport, for the Angels, that Ohtani doesn't get burnt out, doesn't get injured from this, and you're missing him in the second half of the season. But I appreciate the effort. I appreciate the hustle from Ohtani. You know, you have guys who don't even want to be there. Houston Astro players that are taking time off, right? They don't want to go to the game. Other players doing the same. And I get it if you're a pitcher. Jacob DeGrom opted out. Like, he's got arm issues. Probably wasn't going to pitch anyways. I understand why he wouldn't want to be there. But in a year in which it seems like fewer players have an interest in participating in the All-Star Game, here's Shohei Ohtani going out there in the Home Run Derby, pitching in the All-Star Game, batting in the All-Star. He's doing everything he can. And I appreciate that. And I think sports fans do as well. That's where we always get frustrated with our athletes, when they seem like they take the opportunities for granted. Because you always feel, as a fan watching at home, like, man, if I was ever in that position, I would love, right? I would kill to be in an All-Star game. These guys don't appreciate it. Or if you see somebody not hustling, right? It's like, come on, I would love to be out there and have that opportunity. How can these guys not run out a ground ball or not get up and down the floor in the NBA or sit out half the games? That's where we as sports fans get frustrated, because we're so passionate about it. We would love that opportunity. And you see some guys who look like they're hot-dogging or they're just taking time off. They're dogging it. They're kicking their feet up. Or they're looking for an opportunity to take some time off, like such the All-Star game tonight. So I appreciate Ohtani wanting to be out there to do everything he can. And the last takeaway, I'll give you another takeaway. This just popped back into my head because I mentioned Jose Altuve and the Houston Astros, who did not want to be part of the All-Star game. And so I loved last night when the Astros mascot went out onto the field and got completely booed by everyone instead. That's what the Astros had to do. They couldn't send their players there to take the heat, so they sent the poor mascot instead. But at least he's in a costume. You don't know who it is, and if people want to throw something at him, all right, he's protected at least. But the Houston Astros, their goofy little mascot went out in the field and just the boos rained down. I love the reaction from the baseball fans. I don't love that it's the Astros mascot that is the one that has to take it instead of the actual players who refuse to go there and face the music still. Altuve and Carlos Correa. The All-Star game is tonight. We'll see if anything of interest comes from that. You know, the All-Star game isn't what it once was. And I'm not even talking about when it used to determine home field advantage in the World Series, because that was a terrible idea. But even back in the day, you know, the leagues were separate. You had different league offices for the AL and the NL. You had different commissioners. You had different umpires. You didn't have interleague play until 1997. So it's an opportunity to see these guys. You didn't have free agency if you go back far enough. So, you know, these guys didn't switch teams all the time. And if you were a fan of a certain team, hey, you didn't have satellite TV to watch all the games or Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN, depending on how far back you want to go. A lot of these guys you couldn't see play. Most of these guys never played against each other unless it was in a World Series. And there was a lot on the line because they were separate leagues. Even though they were in the same league, Major League Baseball, you had the AL versus the NL, different commissioners, different rules, different umpires. And they wanted to beat the other side. There was a real competition there. You had guys who spent their entire careers only in the NL, guys who spent their entire – they were an AL guy. And other guys, they were NL guys, and they wanted to beat each other in the All-Star game. Obviously not the case anymore. Players are switching teams. They're always playing with one another. We have interleague play every night now in Major League Baseball. We have one league office. It's just Major League Baseball. The umpires, same idea. They switch. We don't have the AL umps. We don't have the NL umps. We just have umpires. It's not the same as it once was, the Midsummer Classic. I'll still tune in and check it out. But I've always said I think the best All-Star event is the NBA because it's the only one that's somewhat different, where you get these crazy dunks and these cool moves. Pro Bowl is like a flag football game. It's even worse than an actual football game. The All-Star game for baseball, it's like any other baseball game you watch. There's nothing special about it other than the best players are on the field. But you watch it. You could watch a Braves game on a Tuesday night in May. It'd be the same thing. Guy's going to pitch it. Someone's going to try to hit it. Someone's going to field it. There's not going to be any, you know, no one's going to be throwing it behind their back. No one's going to be doing these crazy swings. It's a regular baseball game, just with a lot of talent on the field. I don't think the All-Star game carries as much weight as it once did in baseball. Nor does the Home Run Derby, but last night was pretty fun. Now, here was the winner, Peter Alonso. This is one of the clips. I didn't grab the other one where he talked about, I had no doubt I was ever going to win. From the start of the year, from even before they announced the field, he's a very confident home run hitter. And here was Alonso talking yesterday after winning the Home Run Derby.
Pete, would you like to come back every single year and try to go down as the greatest Home Run Derby hitter ever?
Well, I feel that right now, I demonstrated that, and I don't know if I'm gonna do it in LA. It's gonna be such a fun event at Dodger Stadium, but right now I'm just gonna enjoy this one. But I feel like that my Home Run Derby legacy, I feel like that I'm one of the best people to do it.
Peter Alonso last night after winning. Back-to-back champions. Now, we didn't have a Home Run Derby last year, so he was the longest defending champion of all time. Then he wins it again last night. Just the third hitter to ever do it. So, yes, he is one of the best Home Run Derby competitors by winning back-to-back titles, just the third player to do so. He's not the all-time best. That's still Griffey Jr. He's won three of them. He won back-to-back, including at Coors Field in the 90s. But also just the show he put on. That swing, the backwards hat. There's a reason why Ken Griffey Jr. presents the trophy to the winner at the Home Run Derby. Because even though he didn't start it, even though the Home Run Derby began before Griffey Jr. was even in the league, he's like synonymous. He is the Home Run Derby champ. you think of that swing, that follow-through after he hits a home run when you think of the Derby. And there's always something about lefty batters that they just have a more natural swing. It's just prettier to watch the lefty hit like Ken Griffey Jr. than the right-hander. I don't know what it is. Something about those lefty swings. They just look better. And that's the case with Griffey Jr. Pete Alonso winning back-to-back home run derbies. We'll see if he goes for the three-peat in 2022. By the way, last thing on the home run derby, because this is really cool. Pete Alonso, you know, the way baseball works, you have to be in the league for about 5 years before you can really start making some money. So even though Pete Alonso is a big-time player for the Mets, he's still not making very much in the grand scheme of things in regards to Major League Baseball. He's making less than $700,000. And, you know, again, in baseball, that's chump change. In the real world, that's good money, but not in Major League Baseball, especially when you're, you know, as impactful of a hitter as Pete Alonso is. He's made $2 million now off the home run derbies. The winner of the home run derby gets $1 million if you win. He's won two of them. He's made as much money off home run derbies as his entire baseball career, just about. I think he's made $2.1 million in his baseball career and $2 million from the home run derby. So isn't that crazy? Right, from two nights of hitting home runs, he's made just as much money as playing 3 years in the big leagues. But good for him. We'll see if he goes for the three-peat next year. Home run derby was last night. Fun night, right? You don't take much away from it. It's not a very important event. It's just a fun event. You sit back. It's like the dunk contest. Sit back, kick your feet up. You hope to see some fun, some entertainment for a couple of hours. And I think it was pretty good last night. All-star games tonight in Major League Baseball. Same idea. Doesn't mean a whole lot. If you got nothing else going on, you sit back, kick your feet up, watch some of the best players compete on the same field tonight in baseball. You hope that it's fun and enjoyable. But when we come back, speaking of that All-Star game, why the Phoenix Suns should be thankful for tonight's Major League Baseball's All-Star game. We'll get to that when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Coming up, the Phoenix Suns should be thankful that Major League Baseball's All-Star game is tonight. We'll get to that coming up here on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. I got some Charleston River Dogs tickets to give away. So we're going to try to be as ahead of the curve as we can. All right, you have to come and pick them up at the station, so I want to give you as much time as possible. We may not always succeed at that. So I got tickets to Thursday night's game for the River Dogs. We'll give these away later on this afternoon. I got some tickets for Thursday for this weekend. We'll give those away probably on the show tomorrow. Got more tickets for next week. We can give away later on this week. So we got a bunch of River Dog tickets to give away throughout this week. And we'll do it later on this afternoon for Thursday night's game so that you have enough time to get here, get the tickets, go enjoy a Thirsty Thursday at Joe Riley Park as the River Dogs are back home this week. For the first time since, I think, when I was doing the games, they've been on the road the last 2 weeks. So now they're back home at Joe Riley Park here. Maybe the All-Star break in Major League Baseball, but still got some minor league ball going on here in town. Hey, before we get to the Phoenix Suns and the All-Star game tonight in Major League Baseball, I'll let you know what the connection is or the importance. Let's first go to the phones. You can always join the conversation throughout the afternoon. 843-721-9500. We go to the phones because Super Dave is with us. Dave, what's going on? How are you?
All right, Mr. Luke, besides the heat and rain, what else is new?
Hey, it's the summer.
I'm just wondering, I hope there ain't no F word about ready to blow up, you know, hurricane. So,
oh, yes. Well, let's hope the hurricane stay away this year.
Yes. Oh, by the way, at the joke, if you are vaccinated, you don't have to wear that stupid mask?
Yes, if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear the mask, if you're fully vaccinated.
Oh, man. And that heat?
Yes.
How are you going to eat your food there and have a mask and all that?
Oh, at Joe Riley Park, you're saying? Yeah, they stopped requiring masks if you're vaccinated. If you're trying to eat, you take the mask down and you eat your meal.
I think we'll need to cut a hole in the middle of that thing right where your mouth is and You only got to stuff the food down your throat there.
I think that defeats the purpose of the mask, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, with the vaccinations, do you really need a mask?
No. If you're vaccinated, you don't need a mask.
See? So I don't get it. You know, I wish the governor just lifted everything up so everything be back to normal.
Did you pay attention to the home run derby last night?
Not really. I didn't. I was like, Bob, that thing is kind of boring.
If you were given 3 minutes, how many home runs do you think you could hit?
Maybe one.
One?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe we ought to try it sometime.
All right. We'll take you to Joe Riley Park, and we'll see if you can hit one out of there. Good luck. Tonight, we have the All-Star Game. And the NBA Finals continues with Game 4 tomorrow. The Phoenix Suns should be thankful for tonight's All-Star Game. If you look at the NBA Finals schedule, the only time they usually have 2 days off in between games is for travel, right? Normally, they play a game, have a day off, play the next night. If you have to travel, you take 2 days off. Well, there's no travel involved from game 3 to 4, and yet they have 2 days off. Why? Because the NBA did not want to compete with tonight's All-Star Game. So they played on Sunday, took yesterday off, will take tonight off, they'll get back tomorrow. 2 days off in between games without any travel. It's a nice break for the players. And so if you're the Bucks, you might think that Milwaukee appreciates that the most. That the Bucks could benefit from that more than the Suns because you have the Giannis injury. Now he gets to rest up for 2 days. But Phoenix will really benefit from this as well, or at least they can. Because all three of their quote-unquote big three, their three best players, Chris Paul, Devin Booker, DeAndre Ayton, all played more than 41 minutes in Game 2 of the NBA Finals. They then had to travel to Milwaukee, came back in Game 3, lost the first game of the series, and did not play well. In fact, Devin Booker, who played over 41 minutes in Game 2, followed that up with a poor performance in Game 3, his worst of the playoffs. He shot just 3 of 14. And Devin Booker has played over 40 minutes in 9 of the previous 10 games. It's the time of year here in the playoffs where you have to push yourselves. And by this time of year, when you're playing more minutes, you may not be used to doing so compared to what you were handling in the regular season, where you're not playing every night, you're not playing all of the minutes, you come out for the second quarter, you get a blow here every once in a while, right? You don't have to play the next game. Now in the NBA Finals, you're playing at a higher intensity, there's more on the line, you're playing more minutes, playing more frequently throughout the week. And for Devin Booker, he's playing over 40 minutes per night, and maybe at this point it's catching up to him, even though he's only 24. Maybe that's why Phoenix chose to sit him in the fourth quarter of Game 3. Chris Paul is 36 years old. He has an injury history this time of year. Had an injury earlier this postseason already. He's one of a very few point guards at his age to play over 500 playoff minutes, right, in a postseason. He's played over 500 playoff minutes. That has only happened twice before for point guards his age or older. Jason Kidd did it 10 years ago. Gary Payton did it 15 years ago. So Chris Paul is the first player of his age to play this many minutes in the postseason in 10 years and one of three guys to ever do it. Asking a point guard that age to play over 40 minutes is not common. Asking any player, but, you know, it's tough on a center because you're a big guy, you got to get up and down the floor. It's tough on a point guard because for a lot of teams, you're working the hardest. You're handling the ball. You're guarding the ball handler on the other side. Maybe you have to break some pressure. Right, you got the ball in your hands more than anyone else. You have to distribute. You have to try to penetrate. You have to now be a scorer these days. Those are taxing minutes on a point guard, especially when you're 36. You've played all these minutes already this season, and you're pushing it here in the NBA Finals, playing over 40 minutes a night. Only 5 point guards have ever played over 40 minutes on average in the postseason in that age range. Jason Kidd, Gary Payton, Ray Allen, Mark Jackson, Derek Fisher. Right, so Chris Paul joins that company of the guards to put up these type of minutes in the NBA playoffs. Not common. It's rare for a guy that old to be playing this much. And Chris Paul is already someone who's been burned by injuries in his postseason career. Right, he's already burnt out or, for one reason or another, has suffered injuries this time of year. You hope it doesn't happen at this point in the NBA Finals. And Chris Paul wasn't great in Game 3 either. Go back a couple years ago, Chris Paul played 41 minutes in Game 4 against the Golden State Warriors, back when he was with the Houston Rockets in that Western Conference Finals. 41 minutes in Game 4, he got injured 2 nights later in Game 5. was done. His season was over, and therefore so too was the Rockets' season. They blew that 3-1 lead to the Warriors, who went on to the NBA Finals. Then there's the third player of the equation, DeAndre Ayton, the big guy, who's young. Right? He's only 22, but a 7-footer, trying to get up and down the floor, playing a lot of minutes. He played 41 minutes himself in Game 2 of this series. He's one of the very few true centers left in the NBA currently. And minutes are tough for big guys, especially this time of year. Right? Again, it's been a taxing season. He played a lot of minutes. It's been a long postseason run at the end of a long season, even though it was shortened this year compared to past years. He also had a shortened offseason, all the things that players have been complaining about. And here's DeAndre Ayton playing 41 minutes in Game 2 of the NBA Finals. And minutes are tougher, especially for big guys. Right, because you're picking up and putting down. You got a lot of body weight, a lot of mass. You're tall. You're getting up and down the floor. You're not as athletic or quick as these other guys. You're running up and down the court. You're banging inside. Those are tough minutes for centers as well. And without Saric, the Suns need more now from DeAndre Ayton. He's playing more. But here's the problem. Only once in his career prior did he play over 40 minutes before. And he missed the next two games because of ankle soreness. So prior to the NBA Finals, DeAndre Ayton had played over 40 minutes just once in a game. And his ankles were too sore afterwards to play for the next week. He played 41 minutes in Game 2, came back in Game 3, wasn't as strong, and the Suns didn't win. No true center has ever played 40-plus minutes in an NBA Finals game in the past decade. Tyson Chandler was the last one 10 years ago for a true center to play over 40 minutes in an NBA Finals game. That's how rare it is. Doesn't seem like much. How come it's the NBA Finals? How can these guys not play most of the game? Or almost all the game. It just doesn't happen. Only four centers this century, right, going back to 2000, have hit the 40-minute mark in an NBA Finals game, or an NBA playoffs game in general, I believe. And that would be Shaq, Dikembe Mutombo, Dwight Howard, and Tyson Chandler. So asking DeAndre Ayton to do something that is very rare of true centers, and something he has never done before. Play over 40 minutes, come back and play the next game. And the Suns' bench is short right now. This time of year, you rely more on your stars than ever before. And with this time of year, with what's on the line, and it's the, you know, your final games of the season, you're fighting for an NBA championship, the first for the Suns. There's a lot on the line. They're pushing these guys. It's like Dan Fouts in Waterboy, right? Last game of the year, can't hold anything back now. Whatever that line was, he kept repeating. Brent Musburger tells him, yeah, we get it. Right, that's like the Suns. Hey, it's the NBA Finals. Chris Paul, you never won a championship before. This franchise is number one. Right, we have to leave it all out on the floor, and I get that. But the concern is, if it becomes a long series, do the Suns wear down? Will we see another tired effort from Phoenix tomorrow night? Or will they benefit from 2 days off and no travel? Getting to stay in Milwaukee because of tonight's All-Star game, getting an extra day of rest, and playing Game 4 of the Finals tomorrow. It could be the reason why they lost Game 3, right? If you're a Phoenix Suns fan, you point to that and say, ah, that's why. We won the first two games, then we had to travel, we had to go on the road, they played a bunch of minutes, we were too tired. That's why we didn't play well in Game 3 and lost that one. We'll be better rested for Game 4, we'll come back and be just fine. But also the concern is, as the minutes continue to add up, what will that mean for Phoenix? They're mostly a young team, outside of Chris Paul and Jay Crowder, but even the young players are not used to playing so many minutes. In fact, they're probably used to it even more, because they've come up with this whole style of resting and load management. That's all they've known in the NBA. DeAndre Ayton had played over 40 minutes just once his entire career prior to the other night. And so even though they're a young team, they can become a bit of a tired team. Will the Suns benefit from these 2 days off? Will that be all they need? Will we see Phoenix start to wear down? Was it the only reason they lost Game 3? We'll find out with Game 4 coming up tomorrow night. Coming up, let's see, where do we want to go? So much to do. When we come back, let's get to college football. Teams that are the hardest to predict this year in college football. Who are they? And what's the proper prediction? We'll do that when we come back. It's the Moore Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Moore Midday Show.
Fire in the flame.
Coming up, which college football teams are the toughest to predict this year? And what should that prediction be? We'll get to that here in the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. Give away some tickets to the River Dogs Thursday night game a little bit later on this afternoon. Also catch up with a former River Dog and big league pitcher about an hour from now here during the All-Star break of Major League Baseball. Just talked about the All-Star festivities and what it means for actually the NBA Finals. If you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand. ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston. Or you can always find the show on demand online at charlestonsportsradio.com or through our free app. Search ESPN Charleston in the App Store. Got plenty to do, plenty to get to here throughout the afternoon. But I saw this from a friend of the show, Brad Crawford. He put out this interesting article on 24/7 Sports where he went through the preseason rankings of many and wanted to see who had which teams were the toughest to predict. And he went and he looked at 24/7 Sports and ESPN and Sporting News and Phil Steele and Athlon Sports, and he got an average of all these teams and wanted to see which teams varied the most. And he put together his list with the average ranking. Let's run through them. In no particular order, Florida was on that list. Florida had some of the widest-ranging predictions. Now, their average preseason ranking was only number 17, which I find surprising. I could understand why people are concerned about Florida this year. You know, you wonder about last year. Was that like a one-year wonder in terms of playing to that level, being a top 10 team, competing in the SEC? Because you look at what Florida has lost. I mean, they lost 12 starters. They lost more than half of their starters from last year's team. They lost their top three pass catchers. Two of them went in the first round of the draft. So it shows how good those guys were. You lose your quarterback. They lost their top two offensive linemen. Florida lost a lot of pieces. And with recent history there at Florida, the concern, the thought may be that last year was the outlier compared to what else we've seen. That last year things came together, right? You had Kyle Pitts, Kyle Trask played well, Tony. I mean, you had three guys go in the first two rounds on offense alone from just the pass-catching situation. Pandemic season, didn't have to play the non-conference games. Some things went their way until at least the shoe throw against LSU. I know there's always concern about Dan Mullen running an undisciplined program, as we saw against LSU. Maybe not doing the best job recruiting the past 12 months. It looked like he wanted to get out of there, was hoping to go to the NFL. How are they going to bounce back this year? But I do trust Dan Mullen, and I've always been in the Dan Mullen camp. And I do think he's one of the best coaches the SEC has. I think he is an underrated coach. Look what he did with Dak Prescott at Mississippi State. Look what he's done with quarterbacks in general. Right? He developed Dak Prescott. He developed Kyle Trask, who was not a starting quarterback for 6 years. Put him into the draft in, the second round with Tampa Bay? And so I trust Dan Mullen that if he has to replace a lot of pieces on offense, I think he'll be able to do so. They do return their top four running backs. Emory Jones will be the new quarterback who, you know, some people are excited about. But I trust Dan Mullen, who knows offense, that he'll figure out those pieces on offense. So if you tell me number 17 is the average ranking, if we were doing an over-under, I would take the over in the sense that they'll do better than that. I think Florida will be better than the 17th top team in the country. I think that's a little too low. I think that's underrating Florida. I understand the concerns, losing a lot of pieces. A lot of people still don't trust Dan Mullen. Maybe last year was a bit of a flukish season. They fall back to earth this year. But I think Dan Mullen and the Gators will be just fine. Maybe we'll take a step back from last year, but I'd put them higher than number 17. UNC is the second team on this list. Their average preseason ranking is number 11. And this is another team I could figure why they'd be on this list. A lot of people thought last year would be when UNC would be competing for a playoff spot. And it was a bit of a letdown. They went 8-4, and they finished fourth in the conference. We thought we were going to get a UNC-Clemson ACC title game, even when Notre Dame joined the conference. It was a bit of a letdown. But as I said on the show before, I think we were just a year early on UNC and Mack Brown. I think we were a little too impatient. Year three is usually the season in which coaches take off at their programs. This is year three for Mack Brown. And you have Sam Howell coming back. You have an experienced and even more experienced quarterback now who should be one of the best in the country. And while they did lose their running backs and probably won't be able to replace them this year, get the same production from their top two rushers, they also lost their top two wide receivers, they bring back their entire offensive line And Sam Howell is expected to be, you know, top pick in the draft. If you have a quarterback like that, he can help the running backs look better. The wide receivers look better. The defense should be better. UNC has a fairly easy schedule this year as well. They don't have to worry about Clemson in the regular season. Yes, they have to go to Notre Dame. That's the real tough one. But otherwise, a fairly easy schedule for UNC. I think that's the only top 25 team that they could be playing. So I like UNC this year. Now, you get to that average ranking, the over-under. The average preseason ranking is number 11 for UNC. I think I would take the over as well. And the over being that UNC would be in the top 10. That's what I mean when I say the over. I think this is the year that UNC will take a step forward. They have in the first 2 years of Mac Brown. Right? They won seven games, then they won eight games last year. They were 7-6, then 8-4. All right, I think you could be looking at some sort of 10-2 season, maybe ranked in the back half of the top 10. Indiana's the next team on this list. Average preseason ranking is number 16. And I'm not surprised that Indiana is on this list either, because Indiana was such a surprise last year that that's another team. It's almost like you have to wait and see, like Gonzaga or even Georgia. Where it's like we have to see it to believe it. Right? We have to see Georgia actually go win a big game or go try to compete for a national championship before we believe they can get it done. We have to actually see Gonzaga go far in the NCAA tournament, beat some good teams, make it to a championship before we believe they're capable. You have to see it more than once. You have to see it over a sustained period of time. Can't just be one season. Can't just be one win. Indiana was a real surprise last year. Michael Penix Jr. was a lot of fun to watch before his injury. You imagine you get him back healthy this year. Tom Allen quickly moved himself up the coaching boards, considered now like a top 10, top 15 coach in the country. But for Indiana, I have to see a little bit more before I believe it. Average preseason ranking is number 16. I would take the under in the sense that I think they'll be farther back than 16. I think Indiana takes a step back this year. I think last year, they were in the right spot at the right time. Penn State had a difficult season. Michigan was lousy. The Big Ten, it was a quirky year where they didn't know if they were going to play. Not everybody handled it well. And I think Indiana took advantage of the opportunity. Maybe they were better prepared. Maybe they were better coached in that situation. We know they don't have the better talent. And I think this year, Penn State will have a better season. I think Michigan will have a better season. All right, some other teams in that Big Ten. Minnesota, I think, will have a better year this year than a year ago. I think the Big Ten will be more competitive in general, overall, top to bottom this year, than it was a year ago. And I think Indiana suffers because of that. Georgia's on this list. How about that? The average preseason ranking is number 5 for Georgia. I would love to see all the data that Brad Crawford came up with. Because you imagine if the average is number 5, that means, you know, maybe they had a number 2 preseason ranking. And then therefore also had a number 8. How wide was this range? How many different rankings did we get? Or was it fairly consistent around there, 4, 5, 6? But that wouldn't get them on this list, because the whole idea is that these are the teams where the predictions were so varied. So for Georgia, some people are really high on Georgia, must be placing them towards the top of the country, whereas others may be placing them towards, you know, number 10 in the country. And that's a pretty big difference. If you're talking about 1, 2, 3 compared to, say, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. For Georgia, I go back to what I just said about Indiana and when I referenced Georgia. I think part of it is that we just kind of have to see it before we believe it. On paper, Georgia could be one of the best teams in the country, but it's like, yeah, well, you know, we've been here before. Will they be able to beat Clemson in week 1? Will they be able to get past Alabama? I think JT Daniels will be the best quarterback in the SEC this year. And the wide receiving core, even though Pickens got injured, is still very deep. They're bringing back a couple of good running backs. All right, they're going to have a lot of weapons on offense. Kirby Smart is a defensive coach. They get Clemson week 1, which is brutal. You imagine if they want to go win a national championship, they have to get past Alabama. Can they do it? They have to prove to me they can. I don't think Kirby Smart is the best X's and O's coach. But I think on paper, they have the potential to be one of the top teams in the country. JT Daniels has to come through, work out. Right? Some of those other guys, there are some questions that need to be answered on offense that we believe will be answered in a positive for Georgia. But I understand why there's still some skepticism, because Georgia should be a top team. But going back to, say, an Indiana, Gonzaga, you kind of have to see it to believe it. It's like the same song and dance. Every year we're talking about them as one of the top teams, and yet they can't win the big games. Or they can't win the SEC. They can't get past Alabama. They're a white whale. Will they even get past Clemson in week 1? If they don't, that will really alter their season. I just don't trust Georgia enough against the big boys to say that they could be a 1, 2, or 3 team. Five seems fairly accurate. That seems fair. Also on this list, Washington, number 21. Washington in the Pac-12, I would take the over. I think they'll be a top 20 team, but the Pac-12 is always so unpredictable, so hard to predict. Last year was a mess in the Pac-12. If you thought the Big Ten didn't handle COVID very well, the Pac-12, they played like four games, so it was hard to get a read on any of those teams. But Washington, I think, will be towards the top 20. I think there are a couple of interesting teams in the Pac-12 that won't win a national championship or compete for a national championship this year. But I think the Pac-12 will be interesting. They'll have some second- or third-tier teams, and it could be a pretty deep Pac-12 towards the top. But I found this list interesting from Brad Crawford. Those are the teams that the experts are having the hardest time getting on the same page with or predicting. Washington, Georgia, Indiana, UNC, and Florida. And it goes back to what I've been saying throughout this offseason. There are a lot of changes, a lot of moving pieces in college football this offseason heading into this year, which could open up a lot of questions. All right, will Alabama be okay replacing all their guys? Will Florida? Will even Clemson replacing their weapons on offense? These top teams in college football. In the SEC alone, 10 of 14 programs will have a new starting quarterback. Will all 10 be able to handle that transition smoothly? Will the replacement be good enough? We'll find out. And that's what leads to these questions and concerns. Can Florida replace all that talent on offense? Can Indiana follow up the success they had last year? Can UNC take that other step forward this year without their two talented running backs who were both drafted? Right, is year three the year for Mac Brown? There's a lot of questions around some of the top teams in college football, which makes it a very intriguing season. Coming up, I want to circle back to Italy's win on Sunday. Maybe we'll even play some more Italian music to celebrate. But the reason why I want to bring it up is because I think that win Sunday, if you're a soccer fan, you could take some optimism. You can feel good or feel confident about the future of soccer in this country based off of Italy's win on Sunday. And we'll get to that next. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Yo, listen up. Here's the story about a little guy that lives in a blue world. And all day and all night and everything he sees just blue, like him inside and outside. Blue his house with a blue little window and a blue Corvette. And everything is blue for him and himself and everybody around. Cause he ain't got nobody to listen.
I'm blue, I've been deed, I've been dying.
Wrapping up hour one here on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. Coming up, if you're a soccer fan in this country, why, maybe you could feel pretty good after Italy's win on Sunday. I'll explain why. It won't just be another victory lap. So, Joe, this, you tell me that this group is from Italy?
Yeah, Eiffel 65 was from Italy.
Wow. I never knew that. I've always known this annoying song from when it came back, when it came out back in the 90s.
Oh, you think it was annoying here? Try living in Italy in 1999.
Yeah, they were big into this song?
Oh, yes.
Oh. This is one of the many classic, I put quotations around that, classic one-hit wonders of the 90s, when we got all sorts of quirky songs. And this one came over from, I never knew that, came over from Italy. It was a big hit here as well. Joe used to get down to this one of the discotheques in Italy back in the day.
Yes, they did play it quite a bit.
It's not bad for that. I like the rhythm of it. But in terms of, like, oh, I was growing up, the kids loved it. People, like my buddies, right? Just when we were all, I was young enough at the time. People, like, play it in the car or just play it at school. Like, people just like listening to the song. Terrible song. Unless maybe you're in the club, all right, then I understand. I had no idea that came from Italy. Blue is also, you know, the colors of the national soccer team. So there you go. There's the segue. And Italy won on Sunday. Talked about that on the show yesterday.
Although the flag is red, white, and green.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know why blue. I'd have to go back and look. But all the sayings around the soccer team, right, is always about blue. Blue's the color. And they won on Sunday. Now, if you're a soccer fan in this country, and you've been waiting for us to operate at that type of level, maybe you could take something away from Italy. Because they went from their lowest of lows to one of their higher highs on Sunday. Here's Rob Stone, a soccer analyst, a broadcaster for Fox Sports yesterday, trying to draw parallels or a comparison to what we just saw from Italy to what we can hope to see from our soccer team here in the States.
Italy and the United States both failed to qualify for the 2018 World Cup, and both nations were expected to be there. And I think it gives great hope to the U.S. fan base that, look, something horrible happened to a soccer legendary country like Italy, and they were able to rebound and just a few short years later come out with a European crown. And now the U.S. men's national team already won trophy this summer in the Nations League and in the midst of another battle for the Gold Cup and all that gearing towards World Cup qualifying. So I think the bigger story universally was Italy. I think we were just so submerged in the English story because they're kind of our adopted national team here in the United States because of the language and the relationship we have with English Premier League and things like that.
Rob Stone of Fox Sports, that was on Fox Sports Radio yesterday over on our sister station. Italy went from the lowest of lows, failing to qualify for the World Cup a couple years ago, to winning on Sunday.
So they went from zero to hero.
That's right.
Or chump to champ.
Exactly. And now I would say it's easier for Italy to turn things around in a quicker amount of time than our soccer team. But it could give you hope as a soccer fan. Like, hey, they did it in a three-year window there. Went from failing to reach the World Cup to winning the Euro Cup. Could we execute a quick enough turnaround? And to try to shoehorn even a local scene, what about somebody like the Gamecocks? Different sport, apples and oranges, but a team that was able to turn things around quickly. Go from the bottom to the top. Something to try to motivate South Carolina as well. Hour two coming up next. It's the Mara Midday Show on ESPN Radio.